Well, the title of this message is True Character. And if I talk about someone exemplifying true character, there are any number of people in the Bible whose names might come to mind, because the Bible contains many examples that we could use and many characters. The subject of this message displayed character in the face of trials. This person displayed loyalty, faith, love, honor, humility, and she was a woman who could not have children. And that was a terrible situation, an embarrassing situation for families, because large families were the type back then, and especially with boys. Now, this wasn't the first such woman to be described as such. And I'm not talking about Sarah, I'm not talking about Rebecca, not about Rachel. The subject of this message is the fourth woman described with such a condition. And I'm talking about Hannah, the mother of Samuel. Her story is mentioned in 1 Samuel 1 and 2. And there are a number of references I consulted just to get information about this. And there are a lot of discussions about it and about her situation, about the conditions in the world at that time, and so on. And because of that, she makes a good example. Now, the situation at the time was, this was about 1025 BC. The Philistines were still a threat to Israel. Israel had lapsed from the earlier high standards of morality, spirituality. This was immediately following the time of the judges, and the time of the judges is described as when there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes, and you can imagine what that could lead to. Now, in 1 Samuel 1, verses 1 and 2, now there was a certain man of Rabbathaim Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroboam. Excuse me, I can't get close enough to read here, but the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite, and he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So you can imagine the rivalry between the two of them. Now, we know today that the fault of barrenness can lie with either the husband or the wife, but back then the wife was blamed if this were a situation. We can see an example in Genesis 30, verse 1. You don't need to turn there, but Genesis 30, verse 1 says, "Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, 'Give me children, or else I die.' And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, 'Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?' Bearing children was thought of as a blessing from God, and barrenness a curse for disobedience." Terrible situation. In Deuteronomy 7, chapters 12 and 13 to start with. Deuteronomy 7, verse 12. "Then it shall come to pass, because you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant and the mercy which he swore to your fathers, and he will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your land, your grain, your new wine, and so on." Let's skip down to Genesis, or skip over rather, to Genesis 29, verse 17 and 18. You don't need to turn there. Genesis 29, 17. So Abraham prays to God, and God heard. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his female servants. Then they bore children. For the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now, it was devastating for both the husband and the wife, and they examined their past lives for causes and repented of all known sin. They offered sacrifices. They inquired about remedies. So it was a serious problem. We know the situation with Rachel and Leah, and I won't go through that. I think we're kind of familiar with that, but there was dispute or differences between them because one had children and one couldn't bear children. Now, when I'll break into the thought here in Genesis 30, verse 16, when Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." And he lay with her that night, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband." So she called his name Issachar. Then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, "God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." So she called his name Zebulun. Afterward, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. And then in verse 22, it says, "Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb, and she conceived and bore a son and said, 'God has taken away my reproach.' So she called his name Joseph and said, 'The Lord shall add to me another son.'" Now, mandrakes were plants that were believed to produce fertility, and they were also used as love charms. People took them, they used them to help produce children. In rabbinic times, women sought to overcome their barrenness by changing their diets as well. They also used clay fertility figures, amulets, came drink offerings, or burned incense. Of course, all of these superstitious practices were evil in God's sight. If all the remedies were unsuccessful, the woman was considered to be permanently barren. And at this point, the husband might take drastic measures, might marry another wife, or at least use a slave to bear children in those times. So that was the situation at the time. Now, the teacher's commentary talks about the right to be bitter if you don't have children. Like many of us, Hannah was sure that she had the right to be bitter because she hadn't borne children. So Hannah's childlessness had at least two tragic effects. First, it colored her whole outlook on life. And the Bible says that she was bitter. She wept often, would not eat. She was downhearted. And in her prayer to God, Hannah spoke of her condition and misery. Hannah's depression in not having children was so great that she could not even recognize evidences of the grace of God. Hannah had no child, but she had a husband who loved her and who was sympathetic. So they had a good marriage. We can sense Elkanah's love in his words, encouraging Hannah to eat. "Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons?" And so often when we feel bitter and downcast, we too are unable to sense in the good gifts God has given us, evidences of his love and grace. She was bitter because of the lack of children and Peninnah's torment. I was going to skip into 1 Samuel 1, verse 3. "Far from being yet another decadent Israelite in the period of the judges, Elkanah is consistently portrayed as one who is devoted to the Lord. His piety is suggested first by the fact that year after year, he went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty." And this is from the New American Commentary on Judges. "Elkanah is shown to be a man both submissive to the Torah and strong in his domestic leadership. His example contrasts sharply with Eli, another member of the tribe of Levi, who failed to provide proper leadership in either religious or family matters. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb." So Hannah would love to have had children, but God was preventing that for some reason. They lived in the town of Ramathaim, or Ramah, and once a year, probably the Feast of Tabernacles, I would guess, the whole family would go to Shiloh, about 16 miles away. Now, Shiloh had been the location of the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. Sanctuaries were far apart, so travel was slow, and people were not likely or not able to attend every week. The New American Commentary talks about Shiloh as being modern Silon, just 9 miles north of Bethel, which had functioned as the early center of Israelite worship of Yahweh since the days of Joshua. It was there that the tent of meeting was set up, and covenant-related activities, such as determination of tribal allotments within the promised land, the celebration of annual festivals, and calls to holy war were carried out. Now, this would have been a joyful time for those with families, but very hard on Hannah. Elkanah offered sacrifices, gave a large portion of Peninnah and her children, but gave a worthy portion, or a double portion, to his favorite, Hannah. So her husband still loved her. In fact, he favored her, even though she couldn't bear him children. The Lord had closed Hannah's womb, and this surprising affirmation, without parallel in Hebrew narrative regarding the Lord's people, appears twice in these verses 5 and 6. Hannah's infertility was no accident of nature. It was the deliberate work of the Lord. So God was causing this. He was deliberately ensuring that Hannah would not have children, at least not at this point. There's an inescapable irony in these statements, and the same God who in the Torah commanded humanity, and specifically Israel, to be fruitful and multiply, had made Hannah the Israelite incapable of fulfilling the divine command. The text statement that it was God who closed Hannah's womb is significant here, for biblical narratives usually use God's personal name when they describe activities that are significant in Israel's covenant worship, a covenant relationship with God. Yet, in this pair of statements lies a mystery. What good covenant purposes can be accomplished through a woman's sterility? What good could Hannah do in that regard? 1 Samuel 1, verses 6 and 7 say, "And her rival," Hannah's rival, "also provoked her severely to make her miserable, because the Lord had closed her womb." So she was more or less persecuted, teased, made fun of, picked on. And so it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. How did Penina torment Hannah? I don't know, snide remarks maybe, parading her own children around, kind of flaunting them, flaunting her fertility and questioning Hannah's womanhood. Hannah was grieved by her situation, but there's no record of her acting with revenge. She knew and understood her situation. The devout Hannah was content to allow the Lord to avenge the wrong committed against her. And that's how Hannah reacted. She was going to leave it up to the Lord if something was going to be resolved and if she was ever going to be able to bear children. On one trip, she wept and would not eat. She was going to starve herself. Hannah's sterility made her vulnerable to ridicule. Her rival provoked her in order to irritate her. Was this what the Lord had in mind when he closed Hannah's womb? We don't know. The thoughtful reader recalls that in the Torah, the people of Israel were forced to endure much torment before the Lord delivered them. Perhaps the portrayal of Hannah's affliction was meant to draw this parallel to mind, thus preparing them for an act of divine deliverance on Hannah's behalf. 1 Samuel 1, verse 8, "Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, 'Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?'" That's what her husband said. Hannah's good-hearted but insensitive husband, Elkanah, attempted to console her, suggesting to her that he was better to her than 10 sons. So he meant a lot to her husband. And the reference, quoting from the New American Commentary, says the reference to 10 sons suggests that 10 sons born to Jacob during Rachel's period of barrenness. The patriarchal allusion also suggests a parallel between Jacob's love for Rachel, Elkanah's for Hannah. At the same time, it foreshadows a happy outcome from Hannah's plight. The extent of Hannah's grief is poignantly depicted. However, the devotion and faithfulness of her husband are beautiful to behold. Elkanah maintained, apparently without fear of refutation, that he was better for Hannah than 10 sons. Such devotion is most often a missing cohesive element in the modern domestic scene. In verse 9, "So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord." Verse 10, "And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish." The New American Commentary says, "Hannah wept and prayed to the Lord in bitterness of soul." A phrase used elsewhere to characterize the psychological pain experienced by one who has been deprived of a child through death. And it gives several references to that. It's experiencing great personal physical suffering. Relief from this sort of pain is never pictured in the Hebrew Bible as coming from a human being. In each case, divine intervention was the only remedy. So wisely, Hannah also went to the Lord for help. In verse 11, then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. This is what she was promising. If God would give her a son, she would dedicate that son to God and to his service. And it's worth noting that Hannah, instead of praying for a child, prays particularly for a son. Even her prayer is conditioned by the society in which she lived. Here again, she is the typical representative of many Asian women today. And today being, I'm not sure when this commentary was written, back in the 70s. So many Asian women today who much prefer to bear male children. And this says, in a clinic in Bombay, 8,000 abortions were performed in 1 year, out of which 7,999 were identified to be female fetuses. That's a terrible situation in the world at that time. And even to some extent in recent times too. We're also reminded here of the shocking stories of the killing of female children in China, where because of the government's one-child policy, and you may remember that some time back, where families were limited to one child, and parents would kill their female babies to allow them to continue trying for a male child. Discrimination against women seems still to be deeply rooted in the psyche of many human communities. And it happened now, 1 Samuel 1, verse 12. It happened as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard, so she was praying. She was handling the situation the way we should, and that's through prayer to God. She prayed to God. She made a vow to consecrate her child to God. And this wasn't a careless vow to gain favor with God, but an unselfish vow, because it would mean giving up her son. His uncut hair would be a sign that he was consecrated. So she made two promises. First, he would be a Levitical priest all his life. And secondly, she would make him a Nazarite, separated unto the service of God. She showed great humility in her prayer. This is the fourth time recorded in the Bible of a woman grieving because she had no children, and she was the most prayerful. You can read about the others. Sarah laughed, says, Rebecca bore her trial with listlessness and indifference. And Rachel said to her husband, Jacob, give me children or else I die. Quite a situation. In the R.D. Bergen commentary in this section on 1 Samuel 1, verse 7 of 1 Samuel 1, verse 7, in spite of, or perhaps because of, her infertility, Hannah was a woman of faith. In fact, Hannah is portrayed as the most pious woman in the Old Testament. Here she is shown going up to the Lord's house. No other woman in the Old Testament is mentioned doing this. In addition, Hannah is the only woman shown making and fulfilling a vow to the Lord. She is also the only woman who is specifically said to pray, and it gives references in early verses. Her prayer is also among the longest recorded in the Old Testament. Furthermore, her prayer includes the most recorded utterances of Yahweh's name by a woman. 18 times she mentioned God's name. She is shown avoiding the faults of the first infertile covenant woman by seeking help from Yahweh rather than pursuing crafty schemes. She also avoided the fault of Jephthah, who likewise made a vow that separated him from his child, whereas Jephthah gave his daughter as a burnt offering, Hannah gave her child as a living sacrifice. And this all is quoted from the R.D. Burger commentary on this section. The New American Comedy also talks about this. Did I say New American Comedy? I mean the New American Commentary, of course. In verse 11, 1 Samuel 1:11, Hannah's prayer was specifically addressed to the omnipotent deliverer of those in distress, the Lord Almighty. Her pain had made her a theologian. No character in Scripture prior to Hannah had ever used this term to address the Lord Almighty, rather. In her prayer, she implicitly recognized that the Lord alone is the giver of life. She also understood that the proper position of a believer in relation to the Lord is that of absolute subjection. Three times she referred to herself as your servant, a term used elsewhere to describe a female household slave. Furthermore, she recognized that a relationship with the Lord involves giving and not just taking. She made a vow, an act without parallel for women elsewhere in Hebrew narrative, but conditionally permissible for a married woman to give to the Lord for not all the days of his life. Hannah was certainly portrayed as more intimate in her relationship with the Lord than Eli, the spiritual icon of his generation. Within her prayers in chapter 1, Hannah seven times used Yahweh's name, whereas Eli never used the term in this episode. He used the more distant phrase, God of Israel, instead. First Samuel 1, continuing now in verses 14 through 18. So Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you." That's what he was thinking. And Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now." Verse 17 says, "Then Eli answered and said, 'Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him.' And she said, 'Let your maidservant find favor in your sight.' So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad." Through the Bible commentary talks about this, and it says, Eli was the high priest, and he saw this distraught woman come to the tabernacle and pray. He watched her mouth, he saw her lips move, but could not hear any sound. Neither apparently could he read her lips. Notice his reaction, which is an insight into the conditions of the day. The sons of Eli drank and caroused there. Eli knew it, but had shut his eyes to it. He was an indulgent father. When Hannah prayed with such zeal in her heart, Eli thought she was drunk. Do you know why? Because others who were drunk had come to the house of the Lord. This place of worship wasn't really the best place to come in that day. A terrible situation. Eli's reaction, as I said, Eli at first thought she was drunk. He could see her lips moving, but couldn't hear anything. Drunkenness was not uncommon in the temple. Eli's own sons drank and caroused in the temple, and others who were drunk came into the temple. Their actions drove some people away from God. There was a contrast between the two families and sons, Eli and Hannah. Eli saw her earnestness and joined her in her prayers, asking that God grant her a child. Hannah left firm in conviction that God would answer her prayer and a son. Then they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord and returned and came to their house at Ramah. And they continued in prayer, prayed again the next morning. They were persistent, faithful. 1 Samuel 1, verse 19 and 20. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. Verse 20. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. The Lord remembered her. Samuel was born. Peninnah is never mentioned again in the Bible. Verses 21 and 23, continuing here in 1 Samuel 1. Now the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, not until the child is weaned, then I will take him, that he may appear before the Lord and remain there forever. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word. So the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. She became a devoted mother. She cared for her son until he was weaned. She declined a trip to Shiloh because Samuel was yet weaned. And that wasn't a light decision. And let's go down to chapter 24, verse 24 of chapter 1. Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, three bulls. She took him up with her with three bulls, one ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and brought them to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli. And she said, oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore, I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord. So they worshiped the Lord there. Her prayer, which we just read, well, read 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through 10. And Hannah prayed and said, my heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoiced in your salvation. No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you, nor is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken. Those who are stumbled are girded with strength. And in verse 5, even the barren has borne seven, and she who has many children has become feeble. Talks about the Lord kills and makes alive, brings down to the grave and brings up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and lifts up. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the beggar from the ash heap, to set them among the princes and make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he has set the world upon them. He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. From heaven he will thunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. One commentary, and can't tell which reference this was, suggests that Hannah's prayer could have been a model prayer for Mary. She loved God, rejoiced over her son, victorious over those who had ridiculed her, rejoicing over her salvation. God gives life, and it's also a prophetic prayer. She mentions the Messiah for the first time. And 1 Samuel 2:10 talks about the anointed, a poem of national exaltation about God. God is holy. God is incomparable. God is trustworthy. Their prayer may have been used as a model for Mary's prayer in Luke. Hannah's prayer begins with an exuberance and highly personal note, employing, this is what the New American Commentary says about this, employing four first-person references that express unbridled delight in the Lord. Even as Peninnah had taunted Hannah, so now Hannah boasts, literally, that says, "My mouth is enlarged." She boasts over her enemies because of the Lord's deliverance. The object of Hannah's delight is neither herself, that she is delighting that she has overcome the disgrace of barrenness, nor her son, but instead it is the Lord who is the source of both her son and her happy circumstances. The teacher's commentary, not sure who wrote this out, L.O. Richards, says, talks about prayer, praise for unanswered prayer. When Samuel was weaned, which according to custom would have been about age 3, he was taken to Shiloh and presented to Eli. Hannah told how she prayed for this child, and now he was given to the Lord for lifetime service. It must have been painful for Hannah to leave Samuel, but Hannah's prayer, recorded in chapter 2, is a prayer of pure joy. Perhaps even more significant, it's a prayer that shows a deep awareness of who God is. Hannah acknowledged God as holy, as one who knows and weighs human deeds. Hannah saw him as the one who satisfies the needy, who is master of life and death, of poverty and wealth. Her sense of the power and glory of God is summed up beautifully in these verses. And it quotes 1 Samuel 2, verses 8 through 10, "For the foundation of the earth are the Lord's. Upon them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked will be silenced in darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be shattered." And what a tremendous reorientation this has been for Hannah. The same Hannah who was so bitter and downcast that she could not even sense God's grace, now saw the Lord clearly. In fact, she was able to praise God in the situation which some might expect would throw her back into despair. The loss of the very child she prayed for, because she had dedicated this child to God's service. What was so different? Hannah now was able to look beyond herself and her own needs. She could sense God's love now and trust him. And she could sense the future that God had for this first child she loved so deeply. Because Hannah truly had given her son to the Lord, she trusted God to care for him and to give him a fulfilling life. She continued to pray for Samuel. She saw him only once a year, but made a coat for him every year. Hannah's sacrifice was to be Israel's gain, and she felt amply compensated. In any case, a parent's ultimate duty to his or her children is to fit them for service to others and then release them. To bind children to one's own apron strings can only stunt their development, and it's likely to rob both them and society in general. 1 Samuel 2:21, and the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the child Samuel grew before the Lord. So Hannah, like Mary, gave her child to God. After she did, she slipped into the background and became immortal through her son. What are some lessons from this? There are some that I think just pop out at us, but what was the reason for the trial that Hannah was put through? If she had been able to give birth right away, Samuel's future would have been much different. He probably would not have become a great Israelite leader. If she had reacted differently to her trial, say through idolatry or magic or resignation, he may not have been born at all. Through her obedience, faith, and persistence, she became the mother of the last of the judges of Israel. What can we learn from all this? What qualities of character did she display? As far as we can tell, she did not take revenge against Peninnah for the way she was treated. She prayed to God about her trial earnestly and repeatedly. Once she made a vow to God, she kept it and honored it. She was a devoted wife and became a devoted mother. She continued in her prayers even after Samuel was born. God was very pleased with Hannah. He rewarded and blessed her for her actions and for her character, for the character she displayed. When we study examples such as these, we can learn from them. We can strive to develop the same kind of character that Hannah and others displayed. And in doing so, we will also be pleasing God.